What I would like to do now is invite up Dr. Choi Kane, who is the medical and program director of the Gunderson Center at McLean Hospital, and she's an instructor in psychiatry. I will, for time's sake, I will encourage you to read through the bio of our very accomplished speaker, who has presented previously on this topic of the how might DBT and MBT be compatible, and in their practice in the Gunderson Center, they really have been pioneers in trying to bring these treatments together. So please help me welcome Dr. Lois Choi Kane.
Okay. Let me see if I can navigate this, and I may need some help. Okay. Thank you. So I first want to thank start by thanking the NEABPD with their committed mission of providing education for professionals, families, and patients to promote access to much-needed services that help promote healing from a very difficult set of circumstances for individuals with BPD. And I also want to thank Seth for organizing this conference, which I think will provide a very active opportunity for people to understand how these very effective treatments can be applied in helping patients and their families. And I'm here to start framing the issue of using these two treatments and address the question of whether or not integration is the answer. And before I get started, I just want to say that my purpose here is not to answer that question for you, but to provide you a framework for thinking about it and just some perspectives I have had using both treatments in our intensive program at the Gunderson Residence. So just by way of show of hands, how many people out there do practice DBT, just out of curiosity? Okay, a lot of people. And how many people have been practicing MBT? Okay, great. So many of you are familiar with dialectical behavioral therapy, and one of the things about borderline personality disorder is that it first came into recognition out of an observation that patients with BPD may have negative reactions to treatments that are not designed for them. And Marsha Linehan found this as well when she was applying cognitive behavioral therapy with a group of suicidal patients who had BPD, that it wasn't quite as effective as incorporating some additional aspects, some ideas from Zen Buddhism and the kind of theory of dialectics into the practice of CBT. Now, as you all know and as Seth has mentioned, DBT is a treatment that has a lot of evidence that supports its efficacy, which I won't review here, but I think another added benefit is that they do have a mechanism for training a lot of people to provide this treatment, and it comes prepackaged and is easy to implement in the sense that there are skills, didactics, techniques that are clearly learnable and accessible by both clinicians and patients. On the other hand, mentalization-based treatment is a psychoanalytically informed and attachment-oriented treatment. And in the last 20 years, there's been a burgeoning of attachment literature that demonstrates the relationship between early attachments and the development of self-regulatory capacities like affect regulation, impulse control, attentional regulation, all things that are really important to developing the stable capacity to think about what is in one's mind and imagine what's going on in another person's mind. It has a good deal of research behind it, despite its later entry into the BPD universe of treatments, and it has the longest follow-up study in which they followed patients 5 years after the completion of their treatment in an MBT treatment, where it's been shown to decrease symptomatology, utilization of intensive hospital services, and increase functioning. And this is a therapy that can be learned by any level of training for clinical staff in a 3-day training. So it's very practical, both treatments are. So the question here is the answer integrating two effective treatments into a treatment program for patients with borderline personality disorder? So there are many overlaps and distinctions between these two treatments, and combining them can be both what Anthony Bateman has called a super therapy or a toxic cocktail, depending on how it's combined. And I think that practically speaking, what can happen with these two treatments that are intensive is that it can get very expensive. So just a DBT response to this kind of scenario would be to apply interpersonal effectiveness skills, help the patient clarify priorities, their objectives in the moment, the relationship concerns, self-respect issues, and use some skills to manage all of those things. And when the therapist says that they are not reducing the fees, this is where distress tolerance becomes very useful. And an MBT response would use some supportive curiosity about the patient's experience of the charges, clarify the situation, elaborate affects, and accept the therapist's role in any ruptures in the relationship and misunderstandings. The real kind of mentalizing activity involves considering alternative perspectives and tying all of these perspectives into the current relationship. So what I'm going to talk about in terms of organizing an understanding of these two treatments are the overlaps and distinctions in these five areas, starting with theories of pathogenesis. I think this is where the two treatments do really take similar shapes, but with different content. So there is a transactional theory of BPD pathogenesis in both treatments. And in DBT, the core problem is suggested to be emotional dysregulation. And this comes from the combination of an emotionally vulnerable individual who has high emotional sensitivity and reactivity and a slow return to kind of emotional baseline. When this is combined with an invalidating environment, which is characterized by a rejection of communication of private experiences, a presentation of simple solutions for complex problems, and intermittent reinforcement of explosive behaviors, this oftentimes leads to an adaptation where individuals develop symptoms of BPD. They have emotional instabilities that cause behavioral reactivity in the context of interpersonal instabilities. Similarly, MBT also sees the problems of BPD as a transactional development. But the core problem here is an unstable capacity to mentalize. And where I have to be specific here is that many of us treating borderline patients do know that individuals with BPD can actually be highly attuned, sensitive to, and perceptive of other people's mental states. But the problem here is that their capacity to mentalize flexibly and realistically is unstable. So the transactional model in MBT is that there are certain biological and temperamental endowments that individuals have that combined with attachment kind of factors that lead to insecure attachments. Now, attachment is a transactional process, and oftentimes there's this kind of binary between whose fault is it? Is it the parent's fault or the child's fault? And the answer is really neither, that there is a combination of individuals' temperamental, biological, and personality features with a kind of parenting or caregiving style that may or may not fit together. So what can happen is, in a poor dyadic attachment fit, there is an underdeveloped capacity to mentalize, that is, understand one's internal states and imagine accurately or flexibly the mental states of others. And there is a broad attachment literature that demonstrates the kinds of attachment that individuals with borderline personality disorder have is both preoccupied or dependent and also disorganized, meaning that there is this need-fear dilemma, that individuals are highly dependent on others and yet highly fearful and uncertain about how those others may respond. And this can create a situation of what Bateman and Fonagy have referred to as a hyperactivated attachment. So there's a lot of proximity seeking, but a lot of hyperstimulation, which interferes with the process of mentalizing. So I have this in the slides for your review in more detail, but the take-home message here is that the shape of their theories of pathogenesis are similar, that there is a transactional process between an individual and either their environment or the relationship, and the interpersonal atmosphere an individual is in is highly important in both the development of symptoms and also the treatment. Now, the organization of treatments are actually fairly similar in a number of ways, but importantly distinct. Like all treatments that are found to be effective with BPD, there is a team-oriented approach and oftentimes a combination of group and individual therapy. The team helps to support the clinical work. In DBT, it's a team of clinicians trying to manage a group of patients, and there's a sense of both common mission, shared responsibility, and support. And in MBT, there's a similar reliance on team to kind of sustain a mentalizing process regarding the efforts to understand a patient better and help them to recover. So these are some similarities, although the ways that these two treatments go about these things are very different, which I'll go over. And lastly, there is some emphasis on transparency, which is also kind of tantamount to psychoeducation, that in both treatments, there's an effort to really make clear to the patient what the treatment is about. So that provides some sort of roadmap or set of expectations about what they are doing in relationship with their therapist in their common endeavor of doing therapy together. Now, here are the differences. In DBT, there's a skills focus and a kind of currency of effectiveness. What is going to help the patient feel effective towards their goals? So the skills really center around understanding the relationship between thought, feelings, and actions. This is actually very similar to what happens in MBT, but through a different route. Also in DBT, there's an effort to enhance dialectical thinking to mitigate the tendencies towards black and white polarizations. And as I said, the goal overall is to be practical, to increase effectiveness towards one's goals and functioning. In MBT, in contrast, there's a focus on the self in relationship and an emphasis on identifying, clarifying feelings and expressing them appropriately. And the idea is that more stable representations or understandings of oneself and others in relationships promote stability through promoting the capacity to mentalize in high-intensity interpersonal emotional situations. And this contributes to a more coherent sense of self, which we know that individuals with BPD struggle with, and a capacity to form more stable relationships, which in effect diminishes symptomatology. And the process here is a lot less on content, whereas in DBT there's a large volume of content of skills, and there's more an emphasis on the process of sustaining mentalization. The function of the groups in both treatments are different as well. In DBT, the group functions to provide skills teaching and learning. And in MBT, in contrast, it's a forum in which people can practice in vivo mentalizing, where there are many minds in the room, and the opportunity to generate alternative perspectives both among the patients and within each patient. And the individual therapies have different kind of orientations as well. In DBT, there's an emphasis on coaching the patient, skills application, and availability 24 hours a day. And in MBT, there's the provision of a mentalizing dyad, an attachment situation in which there is the kind of forum to have an hyperactivated attachment and the opportunity to sustain mentalizing within it. So the two people in the room, by definition, provide some alternative perspectives, and much of this work is done in session. Okay. So this is, again, a summary of these overlaps and differences that I've referenced. But I think the main thing that I want to emphasize, the yellow really represents a lot of overlaps. So moving on to central techniques, which I think that we'll elaborate much more in detail in the individual breakout sessions and also in what we'll hear from Drs. Bateman and Frizzetti tomorrow. There are certain similarities, I think, both in these two treatments and treatments that work for the for individuals with BPD. There is a focus on the here and now, as opposed to kind of some more traditional non-diagnosis-specific treatments that really oftentimes do focus on the past. The focus is on current emotion and current situations in both treatments. And both actually try to promote a process of metacognition or thinking about thinking in different ways, especially regarding interpersonal issues or relationships and emotions. And both really encourage clarity of thinking and discourage vague or avoidant ways of thinking. And in DBT, this is done through discouraging judgments, which is not just about judging something as bad, but more importantly about doing some mental or cognitive shorthand. So instead of saying something's bad, it's to understand a description or observation about what's bothersome to the individual about it so that they can clarify and explicate how events, feelings, thoughts, and behaviors are related. So it's about kind of tightening the focus of the lens on experience. And MBT is inherently focused on doing this, promoting clarification of things that don't make sense or confusing or complex. And this is where MBT really seeks to connect feelings to events, secondary feelings, and underlying motivations, things that are beyond what's observable. Now, this is an interesting topic, which is about certain balances or, you know, in DBT's dialectics in the treatment techniques. In DBT, there is the dialectic of validation and change, where validation considers what the patient says as valid and important and searches for what's authentic and adaptive in what the patient's account of reality is. And that is balanced with technologies of change, helping an individual to shape behavior through management of contingencies and exposures to help them reach their goals of recovery. MBT has a different way of thinking about this that's really embedded in an attachment set of attachment ideas, and what Bateman and Fonagy have talked about is this concept of marked and contingent mirroring, which also really involves a context of the self and other in the process of mentalizing. So the two sides of this is both, like validation, the empathizing stance with the patient, really attempting to explore the patient's account of what they've experienced and start with what's intrapsychic, what's inside their minds, and then enlarging to an interpersonal context, and then providing a marked perspective, a different perspective than what they present. So this is kind of the process of providing and promoting alternative ways of thinking to move them beyond their own experience. So both involve some attention to kind of validating, empathizing, mirroring what the individual says to be their experience, while also trying to move it forward to something that may be more stable and adaptive for them. And these two kinds of sets of techniques involve different kind of influences. In DBT, validation is based on Swan's self-verification theory, that individuals use social opportunities or relationships to verify their conceptions of themselves. So that if you feel like you are a hard worker, having other people kind of acknowledge or validate that through recognizing your hard work would be an example of self-verification. The problem for individuals with borderline personality disorder is that self-verification competes with self-enhancement. So that many of the what we call target behaviors or symptoms of BPD, like self-harm, kind of self-destructive behaviors, they're actually sometimes functioning to self-validate when someone feels bad or unworthy or like punishing themselves. That act may self-validate, and that works against self-enhancement. And that's the dilemma for people who have struggles with borderline personality disorder. In MBT, this is a diagram that I often use to teach people and teach parents about what may be helpful in stabilizing their attachment with their child when their child is in treatment. This is really a diagram that shows kind of the mechanism of how what we call marked and contingent mirroring works. Down here is a child, or we can use the same kind of configuration to talk about the patient therapist experience. But when a person has a kind of set of somatic or sensory experiences of emotion, they know that they're in a state of arousal, and they provide some sort of signal or nonverbal expression that their caregiver kind of mirrors back, but in what we call a marked way. So if your child is crying, it's not helpful to the child if you just start bawling and losing it yourself, although sometimes as a mother of a two-year-old, I do sometimes feel like that. But what is helpful is to kind of provide a little bit of a metabolized expression of what you understand the child to be going through. So oftentimes Peter has this very funny like picture of him like kind of, you know, like being sympathetically sad, and we kind of have these ways of intuitively reacting to children or people in general in our empathic responses. And so this provides an opportunity to re-present to the child or patient what you understand to be their mental state. And this expression of metabolized affect helps the person or the child to develop a representation of their self-state so that they can mentally manage what they're physically experiencing emotionally. And then there's a symbolic binding of this. So this leads to the development and stability of a psychological self. So just some key differences in addition. As many people who practice DBT know, there's a treatment hierarchy that often stabilizes clinicians in the face of a lot of behavioral and affective intensity, and that there are goals that the patient and the therapist co-create that are ordered in levels of severity. I mean, irreverently said, if the patient is not alive, you can't treat them anyways. And if there's a problem in the treatment, it doesn't matter what you do, so you have to address that. And then lastly, quality of life interfering problems. And the therapist has many tasks they have to organize so that the therapists themselves are modeling the task of being effective, managing multiple demands and concerns, and staying on track. So there are tasks like diary cards, managing an agenda, managing contingencies, and maintaining a certain stance that's both dialectical and non-judgmental. In MBT, there's a lot more fluidity to this, where there's more of a flow from kind of the internal to the external, trying to clarify what's going on intrapsychically for an individual, moving to the interpersonal, and then moving to simply put patterns of relationship as they may apply to the situation in the room. And the therapist's tasks are to monitor attachment, monitoring the status of mentalizing, whether their mentalizing is on or offline, and stimulating alternative perspectives between the two people in the room and also within them, that ideas about experience change over time. So again, I'm not going to go through this just for the sake of time, but you do have it in your handout, some similarities and differences in the central techniques. Now, the therapist stance, I think that when I've observed a lot of experts treating borderline patients, there are certain things that are common, that the therapists are always active, as opposed to the kind of a traditional view of an abstinent therapist, that the therapist is emotionally engaged, not avoidant or reactive to conflict or hostility, which is inherent in the work of helping borderline patients. And the therapists themselves in both of these treatments actively participate in the process. So DBT therapists use skills in the moment and disclose those things, and the therapist in the MBT uses mentalizing in concert with the patient. that both therapists' stance are genuine, and there is a sense of fallibility for everyone, that in DBT, the therapist needs skills just as much as the patient does, and in mentalizing, the therapist is actively also in the process of mentalizing themselves and the patients in the moment. And my favorite thing about both treatments is that the authors of these treatments really promote some anti-traditional attitudes of irreverence and challenge to just really be able to express some individuality and keep people on their toes, shift them off balance to promote change. And again, this is a summary of those things. Now, lastly, the mechanisms of change are distinct but similar. In DBT, change is accomplished through generalization of skills and dialectical ways of thinking to promote effectiveness. So you learn the skills in the treatment and then hopefully carry them out in your real life so that there has to be some sort of practical benefit of learning these skills. Similarly, in DBT, there is an emphasis on stabilizing the capacity to mentalize through in vivo work, both in the individual and the group therapy, and then hopefully in the interpersonal situations outside of that. Now, lastly, I'm going to try to address this question of whether or not integration is the answer. So I'm just going to discuss two cases in light of limitations, and I think that it's often helpful, regardless of your treatment orientation, to think in a way that's not binary, exclusive, or black and white. So by saying limitations, I'm not meaning that DBT is definitely not the therapy for this patient or MBT is definitely not the therapy for this patient, but to really think in a more nuanced way that there are limitations of different approaches. So consider a 24-year-old patient, I'll call her Maggie, who has narcissistic borderline and antisocial traits in the presentation, who's skilled at learning, like many of our patients are, very smart, capable at understanding concepts, and can often apply the skills in the treatment, but the skills application itself can lead to avoidance of thought. And what I mean by that is that this particular patient may be so good at talking the talk that it leads to just kind of a jargon-laden, pre-constructed set of ideas that really don't have anything to do with genuine or spontaneous experience. And that is often the danger of any treatment, that it gets adopted too kind of literally and to the exclusion of understanding individual experience, and that the kind of primary focus is on getting needs met. And sometimes when taken to the extreme, that can actually be harmful or ineffective to promoting a therapeutic process. On the other hand, MBT is very challenging, and in this case of Harriet, who's a 21-year-old with BPD, that in the process of stimulating alternative perspectives, which may be emotionally intense and unmanageable, impulsive behaviors may ensue. And over time, the kind of goal of mentalization is to stabilize the patient's capacity to mentalize so these behavioral tendencies get diminished. But initially, what we found in our program is that some people really are hyperstimulated and need to kind of detach in the moment to manage the mentalizing process. And that can be a problem in a setting like ours, which is residential. So this is just a cartoon that depicts kind of this like more binary attitude of these two treatments. But I think that they're not exclusive. MBT is not behavioral at all, and DBT is not relational at all. And I think that's an important point to take away, is that there are varying degrees to which there's emphasis on these things, which you'll appreciate during these 2 days. But they're not mutually exclusive. So lastly, the benefits of combining therapy, these two therapies, which we've done in our setting, which is a very particular setting where we only treat individuals with borderline personality disorder and other severe personality disorders. And all our clinicians are highly specialized and trained. Our staff is highly specialized and trained. It's 24 hours, 7 days a week, 15 groups in the day, 5 groups at night. It's a very intensive setting, and in a place where there's so much resource and focus, we try to integrate these two things. And DBT focuses on stabilizing behaviors that may interfere with mentalizing. So when I brought up Harriet, in her first mentalizing group, she, when posed with an alternative perspective that was very activating for her, she threw a water bottle and then left the room and shut down for the rest of the day. And this is where the DBT skills were helpful in helping her kind of stay engaged in the process. And one of the things that we may talk about is one of the strategies individuals use for managing a hyperactivated attachment is to kind of go away from the attachment, which is very important. But DBT can be used to stabilize moments like that. And similarly with my situation with Maggie, MBT can support more spontaneous reflectiveness in the context of a heavily didactic program. So DBT skills and MBT skills can support each other. But there are problems of integration. So it's like, don't try this trick at home because there are limitations to it. Because both diverge from empirical models that have been well studied and proven effective, and the combination has not been studied and may be studied as a product of this conference, but we don't know a lot about how it works. And there's diminished coherence, which stabilizes both the patient and the therapist of having a very clear understanding of what's going on in the treatment. And when you mix it up with two different models that are highly complicated for any clinician to learn, it can be very hard for a patient and their family to navigate the treatment. So there's also a decreased sense of predictability in the therapist's response when there are mixed models. And as we all know, individuals with borderline personality disorder suffer from having mistrust and instability of being able to imagine what's going on with other people. So this can create a problem. And when the therapist is using various sets of techniques reactively in a non-coordinated and coherent way, this can be very destabilizing for the therapist. So what I would propose is that there's several ways of thinking about it, which I'll just present but not discuss now, that different patients may need different treatments, like I presented with Maggie and Harriet, or you can do a stage-wise approach. Sometimes when people are needing pre-treatment and not committed enough to do the work of DBT, this is where MBT is more flexible, that they may be able to engage a patient that's having difficulty engaging. And similarly, DBT may be the first step for someone who may ultimately need MBT, that there's a set of skills that are provided, distress tolerance being one of them, that may stabilize a person's ability to mentalize. There's also the possibility of creating different treatment tracks, which our colleagues Robin and Dan have done at UCLA, is that there's distinct tracks so that coherence is maintained among the clinicians and the patients in these distinct tracks, and that you can combine these treatments in specialized settings, but it may be unnecessary or provide more difficulties because these treatments are effective unto themselves. And lastly, I think that one thing I would like to just address near the end is that effective treatment relies on effective application by committed and grounded therapists. It's not all about what the therapist does. It's also about the patient's contribution and investment in collaborating, and that there is a balance that we can strike between eclectic flexibility and dogmatic devotion, both of which undercut the processes inherent in these two treatments, being mindfulness and DBT, attention to thought, emotion, and urges, the effort to stay on track and regulate attention, and also mentalizing, staying curious and attending to what's going on in a relationship emotionally in people's minds. So with that, I look forward to both the comments of Alan and Anthony. Thank you very much.